You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic, your host, also known as Lance White. Tonight, my guest is Kimmerer Lamas. Kimmerer has just released the first book in a trilogy entitled What a Body Knows, Finding Wisdom in Desire. It's a radical new approach to healing our cultural obsessions with food, sex, and spirit. Kimmerer is a dancer, writer, mother, and philosopher. She earned a master's degree in Christianity and culture from Harvard Divinity School and a PhD in theology of the modern West from Harvard University. After 15 years as a student, research fellow, and lecturer at Harvard, she realized it would be necessary for her to leave academic life in order to advance her work further. She needed to create a way of living that would enable her to generate alternatives to the mind-over-body models of human being that dominate our society. Now, her life on the farm, dancing and writing, surrounded by her growing children, is providing her with the opportunities and experiences she needs in order to work out her account of why movement matters. So let's find out where that journey has taken her and what she has discovered along the way by welcoming her to the show now. Hi, Kimmerer. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Lance.
Good. You had quite a long stint with higher education and theology at one of the, you know, best-known schools in the world. What was that like?
It was very long. I think I was in school for a total of 24 years.
Oh, my.
Starting in kindergarten.
Yeah.
You know, Harvard is a wonderful place, and I spent the most time there in that institution, and especially when I was teaching there, I was teaching for the Committee on the Study of Religion, so I was teaching religion classes to these Harvard undergraduates, and they were just wonderful people and great students and great minds, and it was challenging, enriching, and it enabled me to really shape my own work as I was teaching and in conversation with these people.
Well, wonderful. Did you have any preconceived notions about religion before you started studying it?
Yes, I did. In fact, I was raised in a mainstream Protestant Christian church and had had some experiences that were fairly significant in terms of my connection to Jesus and my experience with Christianity. And then as I sort of aged as a teen, I started dancing. And I started having experiences in dance that I felt that I was supposed to have in church. In the dancing, I was really connecting in a deep, embodied way with what felt to me something like spirit. And yet in church, even though I had had some good experiences in it, it felt that something was missing. And so I began this kind of crooked path, and I actually started studying religion to figure out why there is this split in our culture between the kinds of things we think about as spiritual and religious and dance.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you, were you able to make any conclusions over the years about that? I mean...
Yes, very much. That was really my path. After I graduated from... So while I was in college, I studied religion, and at that point I was figuring out why religion is the worst possible thing in the world, right? Because it was hostile to this most beautiful thing, which was dance.
Yeah.
And so I left the college, and then I was a professional dancer for a couple of years, and then I went back to school, and then I went back to the dance world and back to school, and trying to figure out, you know, why is it that we have this split, this schism in our society? And I really, as I unpacked it, I began to trace it to what I consider this mind-over-body sense of ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's the sense that we have in our culture just by living and participating in the systems of education and economics and politics and capitalism that we have. And we take it so for granted, and it seems so common sense that we're not even aware of the extent to which we identify our I with this sort of mental movement that happens up somewhere in our head, where our bodies are these things in which we live, for which we're responsible, which we need to make fit in to society, to conform to. We need to impose these schedules or schemas or diets or plans or, you know, on them to make them do what they're supposed to. So what I felt like I needed to do after spending all that time in the academy studying this problem, and I did it and studied it in a lot of different ways, was to really trace it to those just the small moments in our lives where we make the most basic decisions about who we are and what we value. Because it's in those small moments, what I decide to eat for breakfast and how I decide to respond to my partner and how I make the small and big decisions about what to do with my life, that we're actually living and expressing that mind over body sense of ourselves.
It's interesting because as you were speaking, I was getting an image of people filled with beliefs and told what to do, not having the freedom of spirit. In other words, having to conform and not feeling the connection to spirit, because spirit is part of our body and part of ourselves and part of life. And we're told that so many things are immoral or wrong or bad, and that kind of shuts you down.
Yes. It does. And it causes us to be constantly looking outside of ourselves for the answers that we need. And we're more willing to trust kind of images and voices and that seem to be coming from outside of ourselves. We grow up not learning how to open to, listen to the kind of movements that are happening in our sensory selves all the time. So part of what I feel my work is trying to do, in my heart, I'm a dancer. And it's really in dance I found such powerful ways of knowing and being and becoming that I feel our culture would do so well to make more use of. So I feel that part of what I'm trying to do is to say we have trained our senses in a particular direction. We've learned to move into our brains and up into our ideals. We've learned to imagine and visualize these transcendental, very highly abstract worlds, and we can move into those worlds. But that's only part of what we can do. The other way in which we have of knowing is to move down into our bodies and out through our senses, and to open up and to allow our bodies to cultivate the ability to listen through our bodies. Because it's not just like, there's some people... Sometimes people who are trying to address this issue will say, oh, well, there's wisdom in your body. You just have to listen to what your body says. And it's as if your body's just sort of telling you, or it's as if it's written there. But it's not. It's not just written there. It's not like you can turn your brain from outside to inside and then just see what's written there. It's actually a different way of experiencing yourself. You actually drop into your sensory self and experience the movement that's happening in every moment of your life. And it's in that movement that you're going to find whatever wisdom is there.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, speaking of movement, didn't you literally move into to a natural environment to raise your children on a farm?
Yes.
Talk about why you did that and how important that is and what you've learned from that.
Sure. And it was part of the whole decision to leave the academic world, at least for a while. I really felt, for me as a dancer, the times and the places where I felt most inspired to move have been when I'm outdoors, when I'm on a beach, or when I'm in the woods, or when I'm on a field, or in the mountains. It's those times where I feel most inspired to just move for the pleasure of it, for the joy of it, to express. Whatever it is that about our connection to the natural world that stirs something to life for us. I knew, as soon as my partner and I met in the early 90s, we were on a trajectory to at some point leave the city, buy some land, and to create a place for us to do our art. He's a musician, and he writes amazing music to which I dance. So we wanted to create a place where we could do our dance and our music, and then I could write as well about the issues that so concern me.
Right.
So we had this. So in the early 90s, we started what we called our 5-year plan, and that was we would take turns being primary income of our growing family, and the person who wasn't the primary income would be taking care of the children, and we would guarantee that that person had 4 to 6 hours a day to work on his or her art. So Jeffrey was the first one. You know, I sort of sat him down at one point and said, okay, we've got 2 full-time jobs. We do not need 2 full-time jobs. One of us should quit and do his or her art. And if it's not going to be you, it's going to be me. So he took the first turn because I had just completed the PhD program at that time. And I had this wonderful job opportunity at Harvard. So while I was at Harvard, I was the primary income person, and he was home working on his music and taking care of our young children at that point. And so there then that came a time where it was then time for us to switch, and I was going to move to working on my art and taking care of the kids, and Jeff was going to move into the primary income plot. And it was at that point where we really started reconsidering, is this the time, is this the moment for us now to really act on this dream, to move out to the country and to create the place where which we think we really need in order to do the kind of work we want to do. And it just so happened that as we were kind of moving into this open space, my daughter, who was 7, decided she wanted to help us along because she really wanted animals, horses in particular.
Nice.
And we were living, you know, in a suburban area where we couldn't have a horse. And we just said to her, well, Jessica, when we move out to the country, you'll be able to get a horse. So she sat down at the computer one day and decided to Google real estate. So she Googled farms in Vermont, which is where we thought we would end up, and she found this place.
And goodness.
She said, Mom, come here. And I took a look, and I said, oh, my goodness.
Oh, wow.
Because it looked like something we could afford. It looked like the house was a real fixer-upper. I mean, there was not one room that was habitable, but the piece of land that it was on was just gorgeous.
Oh, my.
So, you know, we took a look at it and put an offer on it that day, and moved in a month and a half. So it just all happened right at once. So it was really kind of, for us, it was really just, you know, the universe kind of falling in line. It's one of those times saying, yep, this is the moment, time to go, live your dream, create the space you need in order to really think the thoughts and create the art that you feel compelled to do.
Wonderful. Well, of course, that must have entailed a little bit of adjustment because then you had to fix up the house before you could actually, you know, continue with your plan. Now, were you going to continue with one person being the caretaker and the other person, or was that part already over? You had accumulated enough money and you were both going to stay and do your art.
Right. No, that was part of the challenge. We hadn't accumulated the money. We thought we would have our income streams. And then we would, you know, flow with those streams to the new place. But it was actually just the beginning of my turn to not be primary income. And so Jeff moved here then with the extra challenge of trying to figure out how he would generate the income. It ended up being a very creative time for us both, because he, in addition to making music, designed sounds for keyboards, so he was able to do some telecommuting and work that way. So there was this long period of time where we were both at home working, which...
Wonderful.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Wonderful. And then, of course, you probably got the opportunity to do something which I think everyone on the planet should have the chance to do, since I have my own little ranch out in the country, is to grow your own food.
Yes.
There's just nothing like getting your hands in the dirt and planting the seeds and watering them and watching them come up. And that is non-genetically modified seeds I'm speaking of now.
Right. You are so right. I mean, I feel like we didn't know that we were going to move to a farm. That wasn't necessarily a part of it, but the farm, but the piece of property we found was a farm. And we have learned so much through farming and through being a part of this farm community about our relationship to the natural world.
How
deeply engaged we are. It's, you know, I felt like I was a nature lover, right? I felt like I loved to be in nature. I loved to walk in nature. I loved to appreciate nature. But yet I fully expected to go to the grocery store to buy my tomatoes, right? You know, I mean, there was still a real disconnect that, you love nature, but you're not really engaged. Yeah. You're not being conscious of your engagement in it. Your radical interdependence.
Yeah. I still fall into that one once in a while.
You know, and in part, it's very hard not to, because that's the way community in our culture is created. Community is created through stores and markets and the capitalist system. I mean, that's the dominant form of community. Unless you're talking about Facebook. I mean, really, you know, so it is hard to do anything, even if you want to be as self-sustaining as possible, without engaging to some extent with the community. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because we are social creatures. We are interdependent. We do need to make change as a society, as well as individuals. But it ended up, you know, I came here with the idea of wanting to write the book What a Body Knows. It was the idea that I had brought with me from the academy. I felt it was the seeds. I had worked out these ideas, but I hadn't yet worked them through an analysis of contemporary culture and an analysis of, you know, those what I was describing as those small decisions we make moment to moment. And so here on the farm, I sort of brought those seeds with me, and I kind of planted them here, and they just grew in ways that I was surprised and sort of delighted and felt kind of marveling that was actually had enabled them to grow in this particular kind of way. So What a Body Knows is then sort of the first farm book, the first book written here on the farm.
Now, when did that come out? Just last year?
Yes.
And can you tell us, give us a synopsis of what the major themes of the book are that you're bringing forth and trying to help us all to understand?
Yes. Well, I was looking again for this kind of the place where this mind over body sense of ourselves is rooted. You know, where it really is anchored in our lives, and I felt that one of the primary places is in our relationship to desire. So as we grow in this culture, it's very hard not to learn to be suspicious of desire. We're suspicious of our desires. We feel like desire is some kind of instinct or some kind of animal force within us that we need to control, that we need to manage. And if we don't think it's something we need to control or manage, then we think it's something that we need to indulge, that we sort of ride along without thinking. And so I feel like our culture sort of flips back and forth between these two pictures of desire. But in either way, we kind of are suspicious of it. We think we feel like it's in tension with our moral selves, our spiritual selves.
Mm-hmm.
So what I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of look at the conversation in our culture around desire, and I picked three desires in particular, desires that I feel are being blamed for certain kinds of psychological and social ills that our culture is facing. And so I looked at the desire for food, because so often if you look at the discussions about the obesity epidemic and how people and questions about our health as a nation, that oftentimes it's our desire for food that's being blamed. We just want to eat more than we should, right? Our bodies are hunter-gatherer bodies in a place where there's food available 24/7, so we can't trust our bodies, we can't trust our desire, because we want to eat what's not good for us. Mm-hmm. So I want to look at that discussion, and I want to look at our desire for sex, because if you look at discussions about relationship, about marriage, about who can be married, about what marriage is, about how to make a marriage work, the question that always comes up is what to do with our desire for sex. science will say, oh, well, you know, a relationship starts and you have this great passion and the passion wanes and lovers become friends. And then what do? Your desire for sex is a problem. You either have to corral it or you have to find some vicarious source of pleasure for it. But it's a problem which makes long-term relationships difficult. So I wanted to look at that, our desire for sex, and why do we so distrust our desire for sex? And then I also wanted to look at what I call our desire for spirit. And by spirit, I think of the vitality and the sense of direction and the sense of belonging that get us out of bed in the morning, let us know that we're on the path and doing something that means something in a community, however we define that. And I feel that this desire appears in is if you look at the discussions about mental health, and in particular about discussions about depression and why depression, in particular in our culture, is such an epidemic, and how people are responding to that depression, oftentimes by being encouraged to go on medication or by certain kinds of therapy, so that they can then fit back into the kind of lives that they have for themselves. But the desire for spirit, that longing for vitality and energy and direction, that it gets blamed then for causing us to feel unhappy with our lives. So I wanted to look at these three desires then, our desire for food, our desire for sex, and our desire for spirit. And I wanted to say, what if the desire is not actually the problem? What if the problem is that we're making desire the problem? Like, what if the desire is actually the best resource we have in our lives for getting us to a place where we feel nourished in relationship to food, for getting us to a place where we have an intimate relationship, where we are giving and receiving a life-enabling touch? And what if it's actually guiding us to move in our lives in ways that are going to create, to bring into being a world we love, that loves us? So within each one of these desires, I look at each, and I look at the way we blame it for a problem, and I look at the way we could think about desire differently so that we can open up to find the wisdom in that desire and to move with it.
Well, that sounds absolutely wonderful, because it completely turns it topsy-turvy and puts the responsibility back on the individual, and it also empowers a person to allow him or herself to experience the spirit and the life and the force that wants to flow through us.
Yes, both of those. Yes, all of that. Yes. And it does in a way that I feel, I mean, I say pretty clearly in the beginning, you know, this is not a kind of a self-help book that will say you can change your life. All you need to do is follow this formula and these three steps and impose this. Because I feel that oftentimes, as well-meaning as some work can be, it feeds this sense of, oh, I've got to make my body conform and fit to these images that I have of it so that I'll be happy. And so part of what I want to do is sort of shift that and say, you know, we don't have bodies, we are bodies. And the bodies that we are movement. And that movement is happening all the time, creating us. And we can tune in. We can learn to listen to how our movements are making us, and then participate in that flow, and that we can actually trust that flow.
Well, now, did you also, in your research, discover that part of the problem is, I mean, it is a very complex, interrelated set of webs that we've woven, one of them being the over-consuming materialism that is barreling down on us like a bull in a china shop at every turn.
Yes.
Telling us what we should do and what we should buy and buy this and buy that. Everything is really designed to be marketed. It's not necessarily for the best interest of the individual anymore. It's just for sales.
Yes.
And beefing up the corporate bottom line. So that's a big problem. And then the detachment that we have when we live in cities from nature itself, by becoming lost in these concrete jungles and having to conform to set times and schedules and you know, adhere to this and that, and basically we become like slaves.
Yes.
You know, slaves that are not expressing ourselves fully because we no longer can. We're so entangled with the environment around us, which is unhealthy, that we can't break free of it, or we think we can't.
Right. I so agree. And I feel like that education starts at such a young age where we are bombarded with images of what we should like and what how we should be and what we should look like and what
it's
will
horrifying.
Make us happy.
It's just horrifying.
Yes. And there's very little space that where children in particular are allowed to play and are encouraged to use their imaginations to make up their own games or to make up their own story worlds.
Right.
And so we become so conditioned to having our pleasures come to us, to be the passive consumers of them.
Be sold devices, you know, especially as you reach, you know, even younger and younger ages, these little gadgets that everyone's playing with that are, you know, like RoboCops killing each other and vampire games. And, I mean, there's thousands of games out there that just completely, you know, they're all based on violence and wars and killing other people. That's another aspect that we're being trained to accept violence and wars as part of the natural part of the process.
Right, as an acceptable way of dealing with conflict.
And it should never be that way.
Right.
That's my own opinion.
I completely agree, and that was another part of our reason for wanting to move out here to the farm, because we were in a great place in a great neighborhood, but we were so surrounded, so saturated with culture, that there was no time for the kids to just be quiet and be by themselves.
Right.
And I really wanted to, so our concern for them aligned with, you know, the vision that Jeff and I had for our own art, but we wanted to draw them away and allow them to have the opportunity to figure out, well, who am I and what kind of things do I like and we wanted them to feel bored, which they never are, actually.
Right.
Because once you realize that you are this movement and your movements are constantly making you, there's constantly ideas bubbling up inside of you that you can learn to listen to, then you realize what an incredible pleasure there is in doing that. And it's a pleasure that is more fully bodily, sensorially yours than the kinds of pleasure you can get through electronic devices.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, I couldn't agree with that more.
Yes.
You know, and the most important one being the revivification of one's imagination.
Yes.
I mean, that's something that people are losing. They're losing their minds.
Right.
And not in a good way. You know, their imagination is being replaced by, you know, preformatted conclusions and ideas and beliefs that are then... They go into the mind and they stay there, and the mind can't make a determination between what's real and what's not real.
Right.
You know, so watching television, it sees these things, and as far as it knows, that is reality.
Exactly. Yes, and it's addictive. That's
yes,
the other thing,
is.
Because it does deliver a pleasure. It delivers a charge which seems easy and like it's free. Like, it doesn't seem like there's a cost to it. It doesn't seem like there's a downside. You just sort of plug in and you get this charge.
Yeah.
But you actually begin to lose the ability to know what it is you're missing.
Yes.
And that's the scary part.
Yes, it is. Yeah, we're becoming mass hypnotized. Well, we've been mass hypnotized since birth. I mean, I was born in 1950, so I'm part of the television generation, but I've seen it develop.
Right.
And my goodness gracious, it has become so slick and so packaged and so refined and so subtle that you can't even, you know, there are people who do marketing that are paid millions of dollars just to brand something.
Right.
And it's really horrifying when I see the amount of commercials that are just, you know, coming down the pike like, it's almost like being fired at with a machine gun.
Right. Yes, I oftentimes think of that as a barrage, a sensory barrage. Really, yes.
Yeah.
So, and I feel like part of what I wanted to do in writing this book, What a Body Knows, is to try to open up the question, well, if we do want to navigate ourselves in this world, you know, what are the resources that we have?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we find them? How do we actually cultivate our sense of our bodies as instruments of discernment, right? Like, I feel like our bodily selves that we have are kind of like amplifiers. They're picking up on whatever messages, vibrations, waves are sort of around us, and then are registering responses to those things. And so if we can really sort of cultivate what I call our sensory awareness, we can have resources at our disposal for asking ourselves, what impact is that television watching having on me, right? What is that food actually doing in my body after I eat it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I make the movements that this particular, you know, diet plan or, you know, religious program is asking me to make, what am I creating? What is it developing in me? What is it cultivating in me? I feel like in everything we do in every moment of our lives creates us. It becomes a movement that we've made. It leaves traces in our sensory, emotional, mental, neurological selves. And those traces, those patterns, then become potential for sensing something like that again, for repeating that kind of pattern again. So whatever patterns we're making in any moment are opening and closing possibilities for the next moment.
Well,
and I think it's vitally important that we say to ourselves, you know, what I'm making these movements in my life. I'm moving in ways in relationship to food and relationships and the communities and the worlds in which I am that are creating things, that are making me who I am. And do I like what it is that I'm creating? Or am I creating myself in a way that's enabling me to unfold what it is I have to give?
Right. Boy, that is the big question, isn't it?
I think so.
So in your book, you explore all of this and help. Well, I should say you're empowering the person who's going through this process to ask these questions and to open up to new possibilities.
Yes.
It sounds like.
Yes, I have a phrase in the book where I say that all we have to offer the world is the work that. That the satisfaction of our desires requires. Actually, I say it better than that in the book. But the idea is that you know, we have desires. And desires are complicated. And desires are conflicted. And desires are sometimes clear. And we don't always know exactly what it is that we want. So part of the work we need to do as individuals is to learn how to sort of drop down and open up and sit with that in that place of unknowing long enough for us to be able to feel what the impulses are that are, you know, guiding us to move in particular ways. And so being able to listen to your desires does require this work. I think it requires humility. I think it requires patience. I think it requires compassion. It requires attentiveness. And so the very work of learning to listen to our desires actually cultivates these moral qualities that we need in our lives in order to be able to be free from our fears and our angers and our materialism to unfold what it is we have to give.
Oh, absolutely. It seems like an important part of that would also include non-judgmentalism.
Yes.
You know, not judging yourself for your desires. In other words, if we're going to allow them to come up, which is a healthy way to express them, we can't be judging our desires, even if it's something that is not necessarily morally acceptable to someone else in society.
Yes. I think that's
you know, because when you repress your desires, you end up with people like Jeffrey Dahmer.
Right.
And, you know, that have stuffed, and, you know, at some point, the wound comes out, and it's not pretty when it does come out.
Right. A violated desire is a violent desire. I mean, it just, I definitely believe that. And I think oftentimes the desire can come up that we find is disturbing. And
that
disturbing nature of it is part of what its meaning is to us. And
so
I think, you know, when we have a desire that strikes us as disturbing, that's a real call for us to sit and listen and to allow it. I have some sort of ways I talk about in the book of how you can actually create space to allow your desires to unfold. And I think, and it's my sense that when we have desires that strike us as disturbing, that when we actually allow them to unfold, that we'll find the impulse to connect that's at the center of it. You know, I think that most of the kind of reasons that we feel that if you have a desire to sort of hurt somebody or to that you want to take revenge or that you're angry or you feel like you want to have sex with somebody who's outside of your relationship or you want to stuff yourself with food or there's different kind of there's a whole range of what I would call sort of yuck feelings or sort of desires which are sort of disturbing because they have a kind of a violent aspect to them. There's an aspect that sort of if we would follow them, the pleasure that we would get would hurt in a way.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like so often those desires that come out of that, that express a kind of hurt are coming from a hurt place in us.
Right.
And if we can be honest with that hurt place in us,
mm-hmm.
and that oftentimes takes humility and it takes patience and all those things I was saying.
Absolutely.
And a sort of a real honesty with ourselves. Then we can actually begin the healing process.
Yes.
Will allow us, we can realize what we really want. Oh, what I really want is not to actually sleep with this person who's not my partner. What I really want is to talk to my partner and to say, you know, what you said to me that, you know, 4 days ago really hurt.
Right.
You know
right.
what I mean? I mean,
right.
I really feel it. That so many of the kind of the hurtful desires we have are coming from places of hurt inside of us, which we need to be courageous enough and honest enough with ourselves to allow to start the healing process.
Oh, absolutely. And then, of course, that requires the ability to communicate. If it's with a partner, for instance,
right.
then you have to be able to tell the truth. You
yes.
can't have withholds or things that you're not sharing with your partner because those things grow like a cancer over
right.
time, and they turn into something else, which is not
yes.
which is could be violent or you know not conducive to the relationship. So.
Right, and I actually talk at length about that, and I have sort of a little phrase which I say that you know when I'm trying to deal with this question of asking for what you need, because it can be really hard to ask for what you need in a relationship for a whole bunch of reasons.
Mm.
You can not want to hurt your partner. You might be embarrassed or ashamed of what you are feeling, or you don't want to rock the boat. You start to really feel like you want the relationship. You want to keep the relationship. You're invested in the relationship, so you don't want to do anything that would mess it up. I mean, there's so many reasons that you think you're doing something for the relationship that will cause you to hold back. But
mm-hmm.
as soon as you hold back and you close off, then those sensory spaces inside of yourself close down, and you can no longer feel that, you know, your love and your passion flowing through those places inside of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what I say is, you know, if you ask for what you need, you have more to give. Because if you're asked for what you need, if you're honest and you're open with the kinds of things that are that the relationship is creating in you, then mm. You are free to feel through those
mm-hmm.
spaces. So, you know, the kind of, and I also talk about asking in terms of asking for what you need in order to give and receive a life-enabling touch. I feel that's sort of, to take a step back, when I sort of go into relationships and talk about relationships and I talk about the desire for sex and how it has been shaped by this material culture that we've been talking about, that we sort of feel like sex is this physical act, and we just have it or we don't, and if we have it, we're satisfied, and we don't, we're not. And
right.
It's separate somehow from love. So love is this
right.
emotion, and sex is this physical act. And, of course, the
right.
best thing is if they can get together, but they can't always get together. So we
right.
sometimes we have sex because we want to, because we think we're in love, and sometimes we don't because we think we're in love, but they're separated. So,
yeah.
So part of what I want to sort of ask the question is, well, what if our desire for sex is actually guiding us to learn how to love?
Oh.
What if the kind of work we need to do in learning how to give and receive a life-enabling touch is the work
oh.
we need to do in order to open one another to one another, to feel the love that's connecting us?
What an interesting way to see it.
Yeah.
I like that. Instead of placing blame or, categorizing it, you're turning it into something constructive.
Right.
That can take you where places where you might want to go, and reunify or heal the division that we imagine that is created there.
Yes.
Interesting. Very
yes.
interesting.
I mean,
well, you also write for Psychology Today, don't you?
Yes.
I was reading one of your articles, so it's not surprising that you would have some new ways of viewing things that maybe we've forgotten how to look at,
right.
maybe we've never really known how to look at them properly.
Right. There's in the Psychology Today, if you go into the blog section and you look under health, that's where you'll find my blog, and it's actually the title of my book. It's called What a Body Knows. And in that blog, there's actually one that I've written recently called Giving the Gift of Yourself. And it deals with this very issue that we're talking about now in relationships.
And while we're talking about that, mention what your website is so people can find your website and then link to your blog as well.
Sure. The quickest way to get to the website is to follow the title of the book. So it's www.whatabodyknows, all one word, .com. And that will take you to the section of our website that has my writing, and there will be also a link to the Psychology Today website in that section of our website.
Good, good, thanks.
So our whole project here on the farm is what we call Vital Arts. And so Vital Arts Media is kind of the umbrella under which you'll find, on that site you'll find my writing, so this book, and you'll find discussions, you'll find information about my dancing, and you'll also find information about my husband Jeffrey's music. So it's all there.
Good, good.
But the quickest way is to get through What a Body Knows. Just whatabodyknows.com will take you right there.
So have you, in all of your life, have you ever been happier than you are now?
No.
Because it sounds like you're really living your dream.
Yes, we are.
And I mean, it's such a beautiful way of self-expression, and then sharing that with other people, and those people who will gravitate naturally to what you have to share will be the ones that probably get the most out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and just because when we're living our dream doesn't make it easy. there are all kinds of challenges that come up. But what's different is that we know that the challenges that are coming up are requiring us to grow in ways we want to grow.
Yes.
And
yes.
That is, if you have challenges in your life which aren't enabling or requiring you to grow in ways that you want to grow, then they're not enlivening.
Right.
Then you can feel
absolutely
beaten down
right.
and really stressed out. But it is true that we feel that the challenges that we're facing in our lives are really the kind of challenges we need and want in order to become who we are.
Oh, absolutely. Personally, for me, I try to set aside as much of the day as possible to do nothing.
Yes.
So that I can just have that space, that wonderful
right.
space to just be.
Right.
And that might mean doing, walking around the garden or, but it's a space where I can think and breathe and look at the trees and feel the wind and look at the birds eating the bird seed. And, you know, it doesn't get much better than that.
Right. You really bring your senses to life.
Yeah. And I also notice that when I go down to the store, you know, 2 miles down the hill, it's a totally different experience of, you know, navigating and fast cars and people with cell phones, and it's almost a frightening world when you're when you become accustomed to living in a peaceful environment, and nature is naturally peaceful.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's violence in nature too. I'm not saying that there's nothing. You know, there was a fox recently that was killing chickens and ate two of my cats.
Wow.
But
right.
You know, those things happen in nature, and it's not entirely, you know, all love and light and fluffy bunnies.
Right.
But that certainly is a lot more peaceful than the human lives that we've created in the cities and in trying to engage and take over other countries for their resources.
Yes. I feel what you're saying is so important. I feel that we still think of the natural world as kind of a material place in which we live, rather than thinking of it as our very selves.
Yes.
I mean, we are earth, fire, wind, water. We are. And I think that's why it feels so peaceful in some ways, because we are connected there with who we are. We're not truncating ourselves. We're not cutting ourselves off from the very sources of our living.
Yes.
But when we're not in the natural world, we're cutting ourselves off. We're separating ourselves with concrete and glass and, you know, purified air and you know, old and far away, you know, foods that have come from far away. I mean, we separate ourselves in so many ways
from
the very most basic sources of our own living.
Well, in many ways, it's really the cause of the death of the spirit and the connection to everything. And it's also kind of a genocidal, there's a genocidal effect. We have rarefied ourselves to the point where we could easily become extinct as a result of separating so far from the source.
Right.
And you know, there's nothing religious or you know, I'm not necessarily a religious person. I'm a spiritual person, if anything. But, you know, we have separated ourselves from the source, which is powerful.
Right.
And, you know, we think we are the power, and I think that's creating some very serious problems today.
I think you're completely right.
All you have to do is just, you know, turn on the television set for 2 minutes, and you can see, my goodness, it's just a wall of lies and manipulations and distortions and ego and vanity and pompous windbags that think they're important, and all for what? You know, to take over more country, more trillions of dollars. It's just really a sad, sad state of affairs.
Well, and I really feel like you mentioned that What a Body Knows was the first in a trilogy.
Oh, yes.
And so I'm really the second book of this trilogy is called Family Planting, a farm-fed philosophy of human relations. And it's going to be coming out in January of next year, so it's in production right now. And
in this
book, I really talk about our relationship to the natural world and our relationship to those sort of primary people in our lives who enable us to be who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I focus on our relationship to our parents, our relationship to our partners or those we choose to accompany us along the path, and our relationship to our children or those for whom we have a responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And really looking at the way in which our relationship to the natural world can open us up to give us resources for learning in these relationships how to live in love. The sort of narrative for this is our first 4 years on the farm here and what we've learned, like the challenges that we've faced.
That was an interesting story.
Yes. It continues to be wildly surprising. And then the third book is designed to focus even more on our relationship to the natural world and the role of dancing and bodily movement in that, in opening us up to experience our connectedness in a way that will allow us to cultivate a mutually enabling relationship with that, with the our environment.
And so, what will the third book be called?
I think it's called Earth Within.
Oh, well, I like that.
It's the working title.
All right. So now have you, you've completed the second book?
I have, yes.
Okay.
It's in production now, and it'll be, it should be published in the beginning of next year.
So you have found in this new experience of just following your dreams with your family who share the same dream, that you're able to just express yourself in ways that you could not possibly have done, for instance, at Harvard or in a in an educational environment or in a corporation.
Yes, that is very true.
Hmm. And, of course, it's not for everybody, but...
No.
But I can't see why it wouldn't be. You know, the old paradigms are crumbling, and it might be that we need to return to... Some older, newer paradigms, you know,
right,
such as communicating and community and storytelling and caring about one another and small community units that are empowering one another. And, you know, there's so much that we haven't experienced here on this planet just because it's speeded up so much.
Right.
And we've gotten lost in the fray somewhere, and I think that we need a little direction.
Yeah.
To find our way out of this maze, and it sounds like your books are a wonderful tool to do that.
Well, I'm hoping that they're resources. I'm pretty clear in the books that I don't believe that there's one right path, and I don't believe our path is everybody's path, but there's an aspect of it that I feel is helpful. When we tell our stories and we share our stories, we can encourage each other to do the same kind of work.
Right.
Opening up to find, you know, Where am I right now on the planet, and what are the moves that I need to make in my life to align with my health and my well-being, and be creating communities that are supporting one another. I mean, create communities with humans and non-humans, right, in the non-human world that will be creating the world, a world in which I want to live. So so my books are designed to do that sort of. I sometimes think about the first one in particular. I really wanted it to be a breath of fresh air, that you just, it's the kind of book that you would read, and then it would shift your experience of things so that you can find your freedom. That's one of our themes here on the farm, is to stay in touch with your freedom. Realize that, you know, you can be going along and doing something because everybody else does it, and that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be the right thing for you. So if you stay in touch with your freedom, you find that there's play in any moment, play in terms of, you know, different possibilities for movement. And if you're in touch with your freedom, you can experiment with those and take advantage of those and move in different directions that allow you to create and bring into being things that you might not have imagined before.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, that's what all of the books are designed to do, is to really help people find their freedom and stay in touch with their own creativity.
Now, I do want to ask you a question, because some people will be wondering about this. Since you have had such a long training and have studied theology and Christianity so much, have you woven that into the book as something that, as part of your personal model, or is that something that you just live and you let others... just experience whatever it is that they need to experience on their own?
I feel that what I am doing in the book is developing a new approach to philosophy. So I consider myself a philosopher, even though I studied theology but much. I consider myself a philosopher in the sense of philosophia, a lover of wisdom. And I consider that what I am doing in my philosophy is trying to create a way of thinking about our human lives, and in particular our bodily selves, that will enable us, that will support the creation of values and actions and ways of thinking that will move us in a new direction as a society.
So, wonderful.
So that is very much there in the books. I've written the books so that they could be accessible to people who haven't had years of training
right.
in these fields.
Good.
But in the sort of in the bibliographic essays and in this particular in the second book in some of the footnotes, I also provide resources for people who have had more training and might be interested in exploring the sources or the resources that are shaping my ways of thinking.
Well, wonderful.
And I also feel in general, spending so many years studying philosophy and theology, especially as it's been practiced in the modern West, I think that one of the things that's been missing is a kind of attention to lived experience. And in particular, an attention to women's experience and the living of experience of raising children and what's involved in that. So I feel that in some ways my time in the academy helped me shape the kind of problems, the kind of questions that I'm asking right now, moment by moment in my day, and then writing responses to in my books.
Well, wonderful. That certainly sounds good to me. Kimmer, we've just managed to fly an hour by
quickly.
I mean, it was such a it just went like a breath of fresh air. So I want to thank you for being on the show and sharing your wisdom with us. And if you would just again mention your website where people can follow your work and find your book.
Thank you so much. It's What a Body Knows, www.whatabodyknows, all one word, .com.
Wonderful. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I wish I could see some pictures of your rant. Maybe you should put some in your next book.
Well, there actually will be a few in Family Planting, but if you go to our website and then you click on the website, if you look in the mission page and news page and the people page, you'll find different pictures taken from around the farm. So,
terrific. Well, thank you so much, Kimmer, and it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Lance. I've really enjoyed it.
Me too. And good night, everybody. Stay tuned for the next show, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night.